Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest round of global cyber attacks and focus on the crippling assault on Ukraine's infrastructure that is widely being blamed on Russia, although Russian companies such as Rosneft have also suffered intrusions. Patrick Tucker, the technology editor of Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move, joins us to discuss Russia's active use of cyber weapons, particularly against its neighbors, that operate just below the threshold of open warfare, but can come close to paralyzing a country. We will look into reports that the U.S. has even greater offensive capabilities in cyber warfare and assess why these capabilities have not been used offensively, as far as we know, since the Stuxnet virus was used to cause havoc inside Iran's nuclear program. Then we'll get an analysis of why Donald Trump is able to continue tweeting out his childish bullying and petty insults aimed at people he does not like or those who criticize him without any embarrassment or shame being expressed by Republicans, the same Republicans who piled on with such righteous indignation against Bill Clinton for his behavior they felt was beneath the dignity of the office of the President of the United States and warranted Clinton being impeached. Adele Stan, a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, joins us to discuss her latest article at The New Republic, First Family LLC, and whether there is a threshold of undignified behavior that the head of state could cross that would force Republicans to stand up for decency and decorum. Then finally, we will look further into the Trump tweets spewing misogyny and abusive insults that reflect his extreme narcissism and insecurity, indicating a compulsion the leader of the free world has to tear down other people in order to build himself up. Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, who is a regular columnist for The Guardian, joins us to question when Trump's supporters, who seem cocooned in propaganda and impervious to reality, will see the real side of this weak strongman. And joining us now is Patrick Tucker, the technology editor for Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Tucker.
Thanks for having me.
And Patrick, what do you make of this apparent, at least being the Ukrainians believe that the Russians have attacked them substantially, shutting down an enormous amount of infrastructure, banks, utilities, etc. Though Rosneft itself, a big Russian company, has also been attacked. So it's pretty hard to figure this one out, although of all the attacks around the world, no other country suffered as much as Ukraine. What's your take on this?
So we at Defense One published a story yesterday. We were the first to actually break this in the news media, but since then, FireEye and other cybersecurity consulting groups have published on it as well. And the method that the criminals used to first deliver and then spread this virus does suggest very specific targeting toward Ukraine. And that plays to the idea that this is part of a Russian active measure in line with a lot of other cyber attacks, different active measures that GRU, that the FSB, that portions of the Russian military and intelligence services have orchestrated against Ukraine. So in order to pull off this, there was the criminals, and again, we're not actually certain of the attribution on this point. There's circumstantial evidence to suggest that its origins are Kremlin affiliated, and that circumstantial evidence is the targeting, but the attribution hasn't fully come in on this yet, so we want to be very cautious before we say we definitely know that it's this actor or this actor. But what the criminals did is they used a particular piece of software called MeDoc. Now, it has a bug in it. It's this software application that's very common among Ukrainian businesses, including utilities, but also anybody that pays taxes in Ukraine is sort of pressured to download this particular application to allow for better tax reporting. So this is part of the reason why Rosneft was potentially hit, because even though Ukraine and Russia are in hot hostilities, they're still partners in business in different ways. U.S. pharmaceutical giant Merck was also apparently hit to a limited degree. There's a couple of different consultancies around D.C. that said that they saw some limited activity, but that's much smaller. But this particular attack vector, this software application that's common to anybody that wants to pay taxes in Ukraine in the most efficient way possible, lets you know that Ukrainians were the intended target. And most of what happened after that is probably collateral damage, including Rosneft, which has, as we know, very close ties to the Kremlin itself.
Well, there was definitely an attack, which, the Ukrainians have attributed to the Russians, that seemed very targeted. And that was a high-ranking military intelligence officer, who was blown up in Kiev in his black Mercedes, mm-hmm. and he apparently was a very key player in looking into Russian activities inside of Ukraine itself in terms of sabotage mm-hmm. and assassination, as well as looking into apparently Russian culpability in the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner.
Right, exactly. This is a really key point, is that it's not, of course, hard to go from watching this to a strong suspicion of criminal activity, because particularly infrastructure targets have become very common in the way the Kremlin right now affects warfare in Ukraine. So we first saw a cyber-physical attack by Kremlin operatives on Ukrainian infrastructure back in 2015. It happened in the dead of winter, and that was utilizing a software package called Black Energy. And we now know that that was almost certainly directed, organized by the Kremlin, using Kremlin malware that has not been seen outside of that particular actor. Black Energy itself is a little bit more generic, but the specific application of it to attack Ukrainian infrastructure and, in particular, Ukrainian power, that lets you know that that was tailored by the Kremlin. Go then to December of 2016, and you see a repeat of that, where they use the Kremlin uses a slightly more customized version of similar software to again achieve the very same effect, to knock out power in much of Ukraine for about an hour. But it's still an important sort of threshold, because before this, the only cyber physical attacks on record, this is where you use open ports, you use malware, you use phishing attacks in order to shut down a physical thing like a power plant, possibly a power station, different utilities. The only record of that was the Stuxnet virus that took out part of the Iranian uranium facility in the Tons. And while no one has taken credit for that yet, it's highly suspected to be an Israeli/U.S. operation. But the Israelis and the United States don't speak on that. These attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure, at least historically, 2015 December, 2016 December, very clearly traced back to the Kremlin. But here's the thing. This malware utilizes a particular vulnerability that exists in Windows that was first discovered by the NSA. And documents that have been leaked online by a group called the Shadow Brokers have created a new level of vulnerability around that original exploit. And we've seen this before, not too long ago, with a virus called WannaCry, which was ransomware, which shut down hospitals throughout the UK, and also some spillover in the United States and other facilities around the world. Now that, there's an emerging consensus that that was actually the North Koreans, because they were able to acquire a particular exploit that was leaked online by the Shadow Broker group, that was able to acquire different classified material, a lot of it, originally owned by the NSA. Now, it's important to point out that the NSA alerted Microsoft to this vulnerability, and Microsoft actually issued a patch way back in March. The original alerting probably happened back in January. But it muddies the attribution game here a little bit, because you've got a vulnerability that was used in this particular attack on Tuesday that had also been used in the WannaCry attack. We're attributing that to the North Koreans, or at least that's where the consensus among cybersecurity researchers is going. And it, you've also got this very clear targeting of Ukrainian utilities, which is something that's characteristic of the Kremlin. So there's a lot more investigative work to be done here. But in the meantime, stay away from this MeDoc software application if you do any tax filing in Ukraine, and you should be okay. And also, you've got to look up this particular patch that Microsoft issued to this back in March. And at this point, because it's been months since this patch was released, there's really no excuse for a good chief information officer not to be aware of how to download this patch and install it on networks across the organization.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Tucker, the technology editor of Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Now, the AP is, of course, reporting that the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Kiev, its radiation monitoring system, had been hacked into. Now, that just raises the extraordinary specter of how much damage could be done with these cyber attacks. Let's focus on then what you just told us, Patrick Tucker, about the shadow brokers who released the NSA hacking tools. There was also CIA hacking tools that were stolen as well. I don't know that anybody's really pinned it down, whether it's an inside job, how this stuff got out. But now there's a great deal of concern. U.S. Congressman Ted Lieu has written to the NSA asking him to demanding that they get their act together. Walk us through that, if you will, how this works. You know, the NSA invests an awful lot of time, money, and manpower in looking at all of these internet systems like Microsoft and Cisco, et cetera, finds vulnerabilities for themselves, but eventually it gets out and then it can be used against us, or in this case, against Ukraine.
So this is part of the NSA's job. Their job is to look for different access points in different networks in order to get in there and conduct signals intelligence collection, which is where they look at different communications among adversarial nations, or, I mean, frankly, the mandate is so broad, and this is a kind of a big political question mark, really any foreign entity, not U.S. entity, but really any foreign entity, their mandate is so broad that they can collect signals intelligence on really just about anybody as long as it relates to U.S. national security in some way. And to do that, you have to develop accesses. You have to find new zero days. You have to find new, and that's a term for a flaw or a bug that was undisclosed when it was used. So you find a new, so 0 days since the time it was originally reported. You have to find new ways into computers, into networks, around software programs, new flaws in common operating systems. Microsoft is the chief target because the operating system is so ubiquitous, but that doesn't mean that Lion on, or Linux or different operating systems are safe at all. It's the NSA's job to develop tailored access capabilities for all of those, but it's also their job to keep U.S. networks safe and to conduct data protection, and they have a cybersecurity mission as well. So those things, some people point out they feel like they're a little bit in conflict, and if you've got a tailored access tool that can be used against a whole bunch of people that are operating or using Windows software, then do you have an obligation to then disclose that? And there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the obligation is from the NSA's perspective. But Kurt Dukes, who is, I think, the CIO with the NSA, has spoken on this recently at the American Enterprise Institute. And I spoke with him a little bit after that. And whenever there's a concern, this is at least the official one, this is the official statement from the NSA about this, whenever there's a concern that a vulnerability that the NSA has found has been released, that it has gotten into the wild, that someone else is walking around and can use the same exploit for nefarious purposes that are not related to legitimate intelligence collection by a U.S. intelligence service, that's when the NSA has a discussion amongst itself and within the interagency, so bringing in DHS, bringing in FBI, bringing in other stakeholders that might be relevant to that decision process, including perhaps the Defense Department, and then they make a determination about how confident they are that the new exploit that they've discovered has gotten into the wild, as it's called, and then they make a decision about disclosure. And almost all the time, if there's reason to believe that it's gotten out, then they give it up. Then they give up the vulnerability, the exploit that they're hoarding or coveting, and they let the vendor know, whether it's Microsoft or someone else, that it exists, and then it's patched. So it's really a question, whether or not you think the NSA should be doing this is really whether or not you think the NSA should exist at all. And there's a lot of people in Langley and Washington that think if the NSA should exist, they're doing legitimate signals intelligence collections in the 21st century. We need to have that line of defense. But the question of whether or not they're hoarding too many of these vulnerabilities, hoarding too many of these particular flaws or bugs, one aspect of that that doesn't get touched on a lot is that it depends on how much good reporting they're working off of. So that means that if you improve reporting, if more people, more vendors, more institutions or organizations that suffered a big cyber attack, if they would report those in a way that was really prompt, really diligent, and really complete, then the NSA would know sooner rather than later that an exploit that they were hoarding had been used criminally, had fallen into the wild, and then they would make the decision to disclose much faster. So it's not enough to just blame the NSA for the fact that they discovered something and they kept it for a little while, and then they, of course, did inform Microsoft, which did issue a package months ago, to remedy the exact same thing that we're seeing now, can have a discussion about whether or not they should be disclosing more and what level of culpability they have. But speaking from a practical standpoint, we also have an obligation to ask organizations, private companies, particularly big private companies, if they're doing enough to report cyber instances, cyber problems that they're having, because that's going to accelerate that disclosure policy. And it's going to happen now, regardless of whether or not we as a nation make a big political or regulatory change in what the NSA can do.
And Patrick Tucker, you mentioned earlier that the Stuxnet virus was inserted into the Iranian nuclear program. I think the actual physical insertion was done by the Israelis, but the bug itself was developed by the U.S. or by the NSA. And of course, NSA is also a cyber command, at least under the same banner or under the same leadership of Admiral Rogers. He's in charge of both. So let's talk a little bit about U.S. capabilities. We've seen the Russians. They've deployed cyber attacks, starting with some of their neighbors in the Balkans, and now the suspicion is that they're attacking Ukraine. And, of course, they hacked into the U.S. elections, which you and I discussed a couple of times over the past few months. So what I recall is just in the timeline with Obama, Obama's now Donald Trump is now accusing Obama of being responsible for the Russian hacks because he did nothing about it. But I believe that Obama, once he got the intelligence, he met with Putin at a G7, I think it was, and told him to knock it off. Then Putin didn't knock it off, and there were more attacks from Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear. And there's a rumor that Obama retaliated, because the assumption's always been that the U.S. has vast cyber capabilities, which they don't necessarily use, they've really got the big guns in this battle, but so far the Russians are the only ones that have been shooting off their guns. Is that a way to look at it?
It is a way to look at it. And the U.S., when they're asked whether or not the United States has a cyber policy, this is a question that if you ever watch the Senate Armed Services Committee, and particularly its chair, Senator John McCain from Arizona, ask anybody in the military or in cyber command, when it comes time to talk about U.S. cyber offensive capabilities, he asks the same questions, and he gets frustrated at about the same level every time he gets the answer back. And he asks, do we have an offensive cyber policy that says how we use our offensive cyber capabilities? Can we let the world know that so that they won't do this sort of thing? And the answer he usually gets back, certainly from former Deputy Defense Secretary Bob Work, and also to a large extent from Mike Rogers, though he likes Mike Rogers a bit more, is we're going to respond in a time and place of our choosing. So U.S. capabilities in offensive cyber, much more effective against an adversary, for instance, like North Korea. There's a lot of very good reporting from Sanger of the New York Times that looks at how the U.S. has been effective in undermining and sabotaging aspects of the North Korean nuclear development program, particularly in its ability to test mid-range missiles through the use of cyber effects, through the use of offensive cyber effects. And they've had some good success intercepting and changing communications among ISIS on the battlefield. But the sort of influence operation that the Kremlin is able to pull off, that pulled off here in the United States beginning in July of 2016, this isn't to say that there's a direct causal link between the election outcome and that operation, but because at very least of the chaos it caused, because of the way it effectively now undermined both candidates, I think you can say that because we now have a hearing every week about this, you got to call that operation a success. Similar to what they did in Ukraine for a long time, there's some questions whether or not they might have influenced the Brexit vote. This is not the sort of thing that the U.S. can do simply because we have a democracy. This speaks to a fundamental vulnerability in the way we conduct ourselves as a civilization. We have a free press that's competitive, that is fed by new information in a highly competitive democratic race where you have two opponents going against one another, trading insults, trading accusations. That's ammunition. I mean, and this is not something that exists in the Kremlin. There's a great report out today from the Defense Intelligence Agency that looks at the full spectrum of Russian military capability. And for the first time in a very long time, they actually also talk about cyber operations, information warfare tactics. And they make the point Vladimir Putin has locked down media in that country. There is no foreign ownership of media. He can control through RT, through Sputnik, through TASS, through official channels, through decisions about ownership, and by keeping media players very closely aligned next to him, he can control the way people have a political conversation in Russia. And when he can't, this is when he resorts to even tougher tactics, locking down services, for instance, like Zello, which is an app that's produced out of Austin, very popular right now in democratic uprisings, shut down LinkedIn, shut down just different social networks, because that's the weakness that you exploit when you're taking information from a candidate, when you're stealing it through a spearfish attack, and then you're publishing it on the web. And he's largely invulnerable to that sort of attack because he owns political discourse, because he assassinates people that point out his wrongdoing, because he marginalizes very effectively opponents. And so he's just not vulnerable to the same sort of information operation that they pulled on us in 2016. And so it really begs the question of how do we tackle this security problem in the new century? Because for all of the ships, for all the questions about how many aircraft carriers we should have, how many stealth fighter jets, this is how you wield power below the conflict line. It's something they're excellent at. It's something we don't have a natural response to.
Well, just in closing, Patrick Tucker, then, do you know anything about what happened when Obama told Putin to knock it off and Putin didn't knock it off, and then apparently Obama did something? He unleashed U.S. cyber capabilities, but we don't know what happened. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, there's a lot of questions about that, and it's not an operation that anybody has owned yet. There's a lot of suspicion that possibly the Panama Papers were related to a U.S. information operations, and that embarrassed some folks in the Russian government. I think that there might have been the interception of different pieces of information that Russian officials have had been holding on to. But the main form of retaliation took the form of sanctions, removing the Russians from their facilities in the United States, difficult financial penalties, and that's where we're actually hitting them hardest. They actually don't like those sanctions, and they are having an effect. And so this is why you see such political pressure to not only maintain those sanctions, but to increase them as well.
Well, Patrick Tucker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Tucker, the technology editor for Defense One and author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, and she has a new article at The New Republic, First Family LLC. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And when the head of MSNBC writes a statement, it's a sad day for America when the president spends his time bullying, lying, and spewing petty personal attacks instead of doing his job. And then going on to say, I never imagined a day when I would think to myself, it's beneath my dignity to respond to the president of the United States. This is a pretty extraordinary turn of events. Not surprising, but still, the idea that the president of the United States spends his time body shaming, attacking people in the most petty, personal way.
And vulgar. I mean, so vulgar.
Right.
And he has a thing about bloody women, doesn't he? You know?
Yes, right. That's true.
Women and blood. Right. I mean, the substance of the text of his tweet was that, you know, Mika Brzezinski, who is a co-anchor of Morning Joe, an MSNBC program, you know, and both Joe and Mika have been pretty tough on Trump. The president made this tweet saying that, you know, the two of them had come to Mar-a-Lago, the president's big club in Florida, on New Year's Eve, and wanted to hang with him, and he said no because Mika was still bleeding terribly from a facelift.
Right.
Now, this is also ironic coming from a guy who we know has had cosmetic surgery on his head to try to make it look like he has a full head of hair, right? but beyond that, Ian, you know, there's several things going on here. When he does something like this, now, I'm not sure how totally premeditated it is. I think it's more like a primal pattern for him. But of course, it serves as a great, you know, shiny object for all of us to chase, because it is so incredibly outrageous. And it serves in his ongoing regime of attacks on the press, which is all about, you know, that's right out of the authoritarian playbook. That's exactly what every authoritarian regime has done, you know, from time immemorial, is to attack the media, and it has been really systematic. I wrote about that this week for The American Prospect, about how systematic it has been, and the approach of not allowing cameras in the briefing room, and then assailing, when they do allow cameras, it's used as a platform to assail the press while they're sitting there. And this is all done to delegitimize the media and to, you know, divide the American people to the point where, you know, they don't know what to believe. So there is some method to this madness, but it all happened on the same day, you know, that the Presidential Advisory Commission on voting issued this, sent a letter to all of the states demanding that they turn over data on their voting rolls, including personal information of the people who are registered to vote, you know, party affiliation, everything. So, you know, so that in a regular presidency would be a huge story and probably a scandalous one, but this other thing happened, right? The facelift scandal.
So do you think that I mean, is there a method to his madness in the sense that he distracts the press and the public from the mendacity that's going on behind the scenes?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Without a doubt, Ian. I mean, if you just look at all of the stuff that, that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agencies, ICE, has been up to with the roundups. If you look at what Jeff Sessions has been up to, going to law enforcement agencies and addressing them and telling them that they don't have to comply with consent decrees and things like that. If you look at what is going on in the Department of the Interior with trying to roll back what we call national monuments, which are, you know, vast tracts of land set aside for conservation. They want to mine that stuff. They want to grab the timber out of it. That has been going on. I mean, it's one thing after the next. And in the meantime, you know, you have this big show, this big crap show going on, you know, from TweetDeck in the White House.
And again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a weekly columnist at the American Prospect, and she also has a new article at the New Republic, First Family LLC. But obviously there's an element of narcissism in this man that's pretty breathtaking, and I often think of it of this, that it's sort of paradoxical that he's both a narcissist. That he's both a narcissist and insecure, but I guess that is actually a part of narcissism.
That
right?
is, yeah, yeah, that is
that
very much.
There's highs and lows, and there's a thing. I believe there's a condition called a narcissistic mortification. Whenever you're confronted with the truth, but it does seem like in Trump world, it is a zero sum game. He has to build himself up. He has to tear others down. Is that how do you see it?
Yeah, I think there's something, you know, I think that there's something to that. I do think there's a lot of projection. You know, I mean, the fact that he zeroed in on, you know, cosmetic surgery, whether or not Mika Brzezinski has ever had any, I don't know, you know. But we do know that Trump has had some, and we do know that at least his first wife has had it. And, you know, so that there's that too, right? There's a lot of projection of his own attributes onto other people, which, you know, as you and I have discussed, there's also, I mean, that's been a time-honored Republican technique in the political realm when they're, you know, making political accusations. But this is so very, very personal. So I think the narcissism is, yes, it's a huge part of what drives him, but it is rarely without purpose, which is not to say that he's such a genius, but he has a sort of primal cunning, you know, in the way in which he weaponizes his own insecurities in this way, you know.
Well, it's depressing that I've always assumed that there's an expectation on the part of the American people in their president, who's the head of state, to exhibit a certain amount of dignity, because we do have a political system where the political leader is also the head of state. We don't have a queen.
Right.
And I recall that even in the worst of the Monica Lewinsky period, Bill Clinton still acted with a certain amount of dignity in terms of trying to be presidential.
Right.
This guy is just an embarrassment beyond belief. And I wonder, I mean, obviously there's a couple of senators, Ben Sasse of Nebraska and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, two Republicans at least have come forward and criticized Trump's latest tweets attacking the Morning Joe couple. Ben Sasse saying, please just stop. This isn't normal, and it's beneath the dignity of your office. So what's your sense? Is that, are the Republicans going to just be shameful forever? Are they ever going to step up and just say enough is enough?
Well, you know, I think that they'll do that the moment the Koch brothers tell them it's okay to. And I truly mean that, because if you look at especially the House of Representatives, which is the body from which any kind of articles of impeachment would have to come, it is almost wholly owned by the Koch brothers' donor network. That body, the majority of representatives in that body, you know, were elected with dollars from that donor network, and if they run afoul of the desires of the network, they will get a primary challenge from the right. So I think that they are pretty much in step until the Koch brothers say no. And while the Koch brothers did not love Donald Trump, they did ultimately sign on with him. And, you know, and that's what the Pence pick for vice president was all about. And they want that tax cut. And Paul Ryan, whose big moment today in responding to the tweet was to say, obviously, I don't see that as an appropriate comment. Well, I wouldn't really, I really wouldn't consider that, you know, a resounding condemnation, right? So if you look at, Paul Ryan has said that they not only intend to pass those tax cuts by the end of the year, they are going to make them permanent in some way. And I don't understand the legislative mechanism for making a tax cut permanent, but nonetheless, I mean, they are determined to deliver what the Koch brothers want, and more than anything, they want that. Now, I think that the moment that that goes through, and it may not make it through by the end of this calendar year, then Trump could be much more vulnerable.
So then, just going back to what you were saying earlier, does that mean that Trump, that the Koch brothers are essentially using Trump? He brought them to the dance. He delivered the power that they control the House, and Trump's antics serve to distract the public from the mendacity of, because I've been so puzzled by this healthcare overhaul, because it's not a healthcare overhaul, it's a tax cut for the rich.
Absolutely.
And they make up for it by punishing the poor. So it mm-hmm. just seemed so nakedly plutocratic. Then, of course, you've connected the dots. Of course, it's the Koch brothers. These people, Ryan and McConnell, a whole bunch of them, are just whores and hirelings of the Koch brothers. So is that to say, then, that Trump is actually their perfect president? He's creating confusion, creating distraction. He delivered them the power, and their guy's waiting in the wings, Mike Pence.
Right. Well, I don't know that they would have chosen this path to power in this way. I really don't think that they would have, but it was the way things were going. And so they made a show of saying, "Oh, well, we're not going to put any money into the presidential race," right? Because they ostensibly didn't like the nominee. But they almost never do. They only did that in one cycle. They are all state-based, and if you are turning out Republican voters, right-wing Republican voters, to get to the polls to elect senators, who are they going to vote for? For president, right? They're going to vote for the Republican at the top of the ticket. So they did a lot to turn out the vote, and Trump needed them to do that because he didn't have a ground operation. And, you know, they do have some goals in common, which is basically, as you say, plutocracy and deregulation and the obscuring of the movement of great flows of capital between continents. And that's really, you know, he can do that for them.
So in terms then of his tweeting and body shaming, which has got obviously, it's been something of a headline today.
Right.
Does anybody point out the irony that Trump's wife Melania, her only cause, if you will, is she's pledged to take on cyberbullying,
right?
Especially in social media.
Right.
What is these attacks on Mika Brzezinski anything else but cyberbullying?
Oh, of course. But the First Lady's office, you know, put out a statement that, again, I mean, was as tone deaf as you can imagine, because here's what Stephanie Grisham, her communications director, said in a statement. As the First Lady has stated publicly in the past, when her husband gets attacked, he will punch back 10 times harder. He will punch back. We're talking about a woman, and he was tweeting about her face. I mean, you know, about her ostensibly bloody face. You know, I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
So I know that there's an alternative universe at operation here, and and that you've got Trump's supporters believing that everything in the mainstream media is fake news, and they believe. In fact, I don't know whether you've seen these ads. I don't know who's behind them. Basically, saying that this great man who's going to deliver America into greatness is being sabotaged by these horrible liberals.
That's the NRA. That's the National.
Oh, it's the NRA's thing, is it?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They're
painting the resistance as this violent, you know.
Right.
Yes.
And that essentially Rachel Maddow is taking down Trump. What can be done about that? These silos here that it seems that Trump's people are impervious to reality and to objective information, but I was assuming that his lack of dignity at some point would resonate with some people.
Well, yeah, he may get some fall off, but you know the religious right are holding on for the Supreme Court appointments, so they're going to let him slide. And that's a good chunk of his hardcore base. I actually attended Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition event at which Trump was the keynoter. And, you know, they very enthusiastically took marching orders from him. And he gave them a list of stuff that he wanted them to push for in Congress. And then they all went on buses and went up to Capitol Hill. I mean, it was really quite astonishing. And he, you know, his approval ratings, while low in the country at large, remain high, not just among his hardcore base, but among Republicans. So it becomes this thing where, because he represents a worldview in which the, you know, liberals / progressives, which you know, really represent a change in the social order by the lights of those who rally around Trump. They'll stick with him. They'll stick with him, I believe, if he gets increasingly, you know, starts to appear demented or does something that is just, you know, even further beyond the pale, we could see a change. But if it stays at this sort of a level, I don't expect them to flee him.
Well, just in closing, tell us a little, if you will, about your article at the New Republic First Family LLC.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I was thinking about, especially, you know, that we really haven't had, first of all, the institution of the First Lady, you know, for better or worse. I of course had voted for Hillary Clinton, and the one thing I was really looking forward to was seeing that model turned on its head, right, of the First Family with the doting First Lady and all of that. And then instead we got a total reordering of the First Family and the absence of a First Lady, but not in a good way. And so I was looking at how this First Family is organized, and it really is organized like a limited liability corporation, which is a small privately held corporation, which is the kind that the Trump Organization is a collection of. And, you know, with the favored children being sort of executive vice presidents, you know, of that family, if you think of the family as a company that is designed to just advance the needs of the brand. And, you know, you get a sense of that coldness and the absence of culture, because First Families, you know, are sort of ambassadors of brand America to the rest of the world and to the nation at large. And we find ways to identify with them generally. And they, you know, they have concerts in the White House. You know, there hasn't been one concert in the White House. I mean, and there's none on the schedule. This kind of stuff is not normal. That's not typical. And you know, a lot of soft power is generally wielded by first ladies. If you think of Jacqueline Kennedy on top of an elephant in India, and you know, we don't have any of that. So that's what my piece addresses.
Oh, I see. Well, just in general, in terms of the emoluments and the idea that this is a family that's continuing essentially, this is almost a hostile takeover or an acquisition of the White House.
Absolutely, that's exactly where I went with it. Yeah,
and that just in closing, JFK, of course, his famous invocation was, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Trump has turned that on its head.
He surely has. Every day he says,
"What can my country do for me today? How much money can I make out of being president?" I mean,
it
is so disgusting. Anyway, thank you so much, Adele. I enjoyed talking to you.
Great being with you as always, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a weekly columnist at the American Prospect, and she also has a new article at the New Republic, First Family LLC. We can take a brief station break. We're back getting an analysis of why the Republicans continue to tolerate Donald Trump's tweeting out childish insults and petty bullying. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Last Great Nazi War Crime Trial. And he is a regular columnist for The Guardian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Glad to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And what do you make of this latest headline today in terms of the president body shaming, the anchor of a cable news show? Previously, he was very friendly with this couple, Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, and even offered to officiate at their wedding. But now he's resorting to really kind of petty, nasty terms. What does this mean in terms of the presidency, when you've got at least two senators, Lindsey Graham and Ben Sasse, tweeting out their disapproval? But in general, what's your sense of how this is playing in this extremely divided and polarized country?
Well, I mean, what's remarkable, of course, is that he does have his defenders. I mean, he has people like Sean Hannity, who basically, I suppose, will defend no matter what Trump does. But, you know, Hannity comes racing in, saying that, well, maybe Joe Scarborough should stop calling the president the liar, as if that justifies the response on the president's part. It's obviously something that is not new. I mean, we saw him engaging in these kinds of ad hominem, personal, you know, highly personal attacks all through the campaign season and since the election as well. So there's certainly nothing new about it. I think it does, you know, I think we can say for the umpteenth time that this man is not fit for office, and his unfitness is demonstrated both in terms of what he does and what he says. And for those who think that, oh, well, this is just kind of like a trivial act of not engaging in dignified discourse, you know, I think dignity and democracy kind of go hand in hand. I mean, I think one of the basic assumptions of democratic life is that people in a democracy are going to disagree with one another. And the only way for democracy to work is if we treat those with whom we disagree with respect. And he simply fails to do that. He simply fails to act in a dignified fashion. He treats other people without respect. He engages in behavior that demonstrates a complete absence of self-control. And to that extent, he doesn't earn honor or respect as president. So there is this kind of sadly familiar, but incredibly dispiriting degradation of discourse.
But unfortunately, as far as I can tell, we do have a situation akin to what happened to the United States before the Revolution, where the head of state, King George, was quite mad and would wander around his vast palaces talking to the trees. And his courtiers would spend all of their time at letting the outside world know that everything was going swimmingly and ignoring the antics of the lunatic king. And to some extent, it seems that that's happening in the White House, where you know, you've got the press people basically having to say the most absurd stuff on a daily basis, defend the indefensible. Well, the very first day that Sean Spicer was on the job, he had to tell the press that the crowd at the inauguration was bigger than it was at Obama's inauguration. And there he is showing pictures where it was manifestly clear that one had millions of people and the other one had a pretty thin crowd. That was day one. My sense is that the country itself, as long as it participates in denial and normalizes the situation, they're complicit in this kind of madness.
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose I have two possible responses to that, Ian. One is the question about Trump himself. And again, you know, I don't enjoy engaging in kind of psychoanalyzing this man. My own view is that he is not unhinged. I think that, you know, one thing that's kind of remarkable about him is that he's never had to pay a political price for both his lying and for his insulting. And in fact, you know, throughout the election season, people said, well, there's no way that someone can get elected engaging in this kind of nonstop lying and verbal abuse of his opponents. And he proved them wrong. And so on some level, until the time that he is forced to until the time that he is forced to pay a clear political price for his insulting and for his lying, I'm prepared to believe that he thinks that he is a kind of a political wizard and that he is defying everybody's understandings of what can be done as President of the United States. I think you're, as a second point, I think you're absolutely right that he wouldn't be able to do this without these aiders and abettors. And some of these aiders and abettors are people, as I mentioned, like Sean Hannity. And then the other aiders and abettors are those in the Republican Party who only, with the greatest reluctance and most tepidly, engage in any kind of criticism of his outrageous behavior.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas. He's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he's a regular columnist for The Guardian. So again, though, what does it say about America and our polity and where we've descended, if you will? And I suspect that in many ways, John McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as his running mate kind of broke a tradition, if you will, in American politics. It seemed to me that it was always understood that you tried to find talented and experienced political leaders and that people would vote for people who were essentially more qualified than they were. Sarah Palin broke that mold and gave permission to people to vote for somebody that's just like them. You know, in other words, you might as well vote for the person at the supermarket who's checking you out as much as you are to some, you know, experienced person. For example, you had nobody more experienced in terms of governance than Hillary Clinton. And she lost to a guy that insulted everybody and had no political experience. Was extremely uncouth and has a record of unbridled selfishness, if not corruption.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think I agree with you completely about the, you know, not simply that Sarah Palin was a miserable choice, but that Sarah Palin represented a very disturbing absence of judgment on John McCain's part. In as much as she was manifestly unsuited even for, you know, the relatively ceremonial position of vice presidency, which, of course, is just a single heartbeat away from the position of president of the United States. And I do think that, you know, the degradation of political discourse in this country certainly predates the advent of Donald Trump. That said, I think Donald Trump has nonetheless, you know, taken whatever degradation there already was on the ground, and he has just gone with it. and he has kind of smashed through one guardrail of decency, one guardrail of probity, one guardrail of honesty, just one after another after another. So I don't think he's simply the manifestation of a problem. I think in many ways he is that problem. And it's also one of these things that, you know, as we look to the future, it's a, you know, it's a scary thing because it's not clear how you walk back these things. That is, once these guardrails are smashed, it's not entirely clear to me how you kind of put them back in place, especially when you have this incredibly fractured media environment, places like Drudge Report, Breitbart, which, again, as I've said, they kind of aid and abet this degradation of democratic discourse.
But I wonder, though, if the mainstream press and the White House Press Association will have the cojones to do something about the way they're being treated by the White House. And it's obviously, you know, that Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Spicer favor the cheer squad from Breitbart and Drudge and Fox, and they accuse everybody else in the White House press pool of being representative of the fake news. And in fact, one reporter the other day spoke back, and you could see that this Huckabee Sanders simply couldn't handle the idea that somebody was challenging her because she's such a vacuous propagandist. But my sense is that they ought to just abandon the White House and just let Trump just use his own propaganda organs, these volunteer propagandists like Hannity, Drudge, and Breitbart, and be boycotted. I mean, do they have the solidarity to do that, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's a very interesting point that you raise. And it is one of these things where you wonder, you know, if you do engage in some kind of boycott, whether that, you certainly run the risk that that kind of blows up in your face, and that what you now have is you have basically a kind of minister of propaganda, and a minister of propaganda who is feeding stories to those who will simply accept them and report them without any kind of critical insight whatsoever. And that, I suppose, has its own dangers. I'm not sure if, you know, if I would welcome that kind of boycott. It's a very interesting question. It's also worth probably mentioning that these media outlets, you know, the mainstream media, which I do believe are performing an extremely valuable check on the president, it's also worth pointing out that good marketing for them as well. You know, they are in a certain way benefiting from the relentless attacks that the president is directing towards them as they become tools of opposition and resistance and gain a lot of popularity in that role.
Well, to some extent, I think they're expiating for the fact that they gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free publicity.
Absolutely.
You know, they're reaping the whirlwind. But I think just in closing, though, you have to admit that the Post and the New York Times are doing some pretty good investigative work.
Don't get me wrong. I think that they're doing really kind of a superb job. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of remarkable to see how they have changed their entire kind of repertorial and editorial stance, that they now kind of configure themselves very much as tools of opposition and resistance. And again, that's a very interesting thing to kind of imagine moving forward, whether, right, you know, these great newspapers can walk back that stance if you now have a very different kind of president inhabiting the White House.
Well, Lawrence Douglas, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence and social thought at Amherst College, and he's also a regular columnist for The Guardian. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank the producer, Jose Benavides and Clemence Penard. And this program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.